Roy preached Faith for the Long Haul, Faith for Right Now in July of 1983. Those of you who were witness to Roy's oratory skills knows that he had a way with words. And so I first offer my apologies that I will probably trip up in trying to execute Roy's intricate sentence structure, but I'll do my best. He begins with this meditation. May our hearts and minds be open to leap over the boundaries of tongue and hear the universal word of love that speaks in them. For this is the source of hope now and ever. Amen. I want to talk with you this morning about faith and the contingencies of life. These come both long range and short. The now generation of a decade or so ago, so that would be the 1970s, tended to forget how quickly now passes and how it really is the long haul that counts. An older generation, some of whose ideas the young were attempting to correct, if not repudiate, tended to stress the deferring of satisfaction, forgetting that now is the only time in which you can act, either to enjoy or to prepare for enjoying. But both of these modes of understanding were attempts to come to the grips with the elements of the contingency in life, a fact that the Buddha also emphasized, that all things pass, that all things are transient. The promises of hope that are proffered to us by religion often seem one-sided as they address these contingencies. An apocryphal story relates an event from the latter days of the flood. The heavens had opened, the fountains of the deep had poured forth, and water covered the earth. But after a time, the rains stopped and the ark glided aimlessly here and there. One day, Noah looked out the window. As far as he could see, it was only motionless water. But suddenly, his eyes caught something breaking the surface. As the ark drifted closer, he was surprised to recognize one of his old neighbors, who had somehow managed to scramble to the top of Mount Everest and stretched on his toes, now stood with the water rippling at his chin. When he saw the ark drawing close, the neighbor shouted for help. Noah didn't know what to do. He went back into the ark to seek out his sons, Shem, Jephthah, and Ham, taking counsel amongst them. They noted that the Lord had made no provision for this turn of events. The ark had neither sail nor rudder, nor were there any oars. There had been no instruction to take a rope on board or to carry a small boat. None of us know how to swim, said Shem uneasily. Jephthah added, besides, it's already a little crowded in here. So Noah went back to the window and shouted as the ark drifted by, sorry, neighbor, there's no way we can help, but don't give up hope. You can just keep standing there on your tippy toes. In a week or so, the water's bound to go down if it doesn't rain. Small comfort. Promises of help in the future often leave us woefully stranded in present dilemma. We have to survive our contingencies in both ranges. Let me give you a workaday description of faith. Faith, as I see it, is that posture of trust which opens access to whatever real reinforcements for meaning or sources of initiative or direction there are. Faith is the trust that opens these things to us. Of course, there is a very pragmatic test. Every claim to our faith must eventually answer the question, does it work? To place our trust in an assumed resource which is not actually there will lead to the existential shocks of failure, dismay, and perplexity. What happened? Did I do something wrong? Is what I trusted there or not? To take a humble example from time to time in our technological world, and I love this story. From time to time in our technological world, you enter a building and go to an elevator. The door is there. The button is there. You push the button to summon the elevator, and most of the time it comes. But suppose it doesn't come. You wait, patiently at first. But as the delay drags on, you begin to wonder, what's wrong? You may not have thought of it in those terms, but pushing the elevator button and waiting was an act of faith. Faith in the designers of the elevators. Faith in the reliability of the power company. Faith in your own familiarity with the signs, buttons, and the like. As you stand, uneasy questions crowd into your mind. They first may be questions about yourself. What did I do wrong? Did I only think I pushed the button? Maybe I thought about it but didn't do it. You push it again. Maybe I didn't push it hard enough, so you punch it vigorously again. The thought may even occur to you that it could be the wrong button, and you look for another. All those bringing no result, you begin to ask still other questions. Why doesn't the elevator come? Is it not working? Has it broken down? Is it stuck at the 11th floor, perhaps? Maybe it's too crowded. Maybe I have made a mistake. The building was already closed and they have shut the thing down. Is there a power failure? Is there an elevator at all? Is this a trick door? But even if the elevator never comes, the chances are good that the next time you are in a tall building facing the elevator door, you will push the button and wait again, fully confident that the car will arrive. The reason for this is that a single existential shock to your assumptions will not be enough to shatter the whole complex of what you take for granted about the world and the trust you place in it. Those of you conversant with psychology will probably now say, so you can tell me if he's right, what he is just talking about is just Pavlovian reflex conditioning and the extinction of conditioning if you don't get the right response. I see some nods. In a way, that is correct. But there is an important difference between what I am describing and the behavioralist experimentations on dogs and pigeons. There is for us, in addition to what we share with animal companions, a cognitive and reflexive level of operations. Our confidence, our set of expectations, our faith draws on much wider, more comprehensive, and elaborate structured sets of experiences. It includes not only what has happened to us as individuals, but also things that have happened to other people, communicated to us in language codes of many dimensions by our contemporaries and generations of our forebears. In short, what happens to us occurs in a quite different theater from what seems to be the more limited and isolated nervous networks of dogs, cats, or birds. This entire larger dimension will be involved in the transaction, which leads to an empowering trust and confidence. Or, on the other hand, the disabling distrust and dismay, loss of identity, and other problems of the spirit on the other. The faith we live by is easiest and simplest, of course. Just lost my place. There we go. I think Dick Color's here, right? He's always happy when we make mistakes on our iPads. Something that Roy Jones would never do. All right. The faith we live by is easiest and simplest, of course, in those areas of life where we are familiar with conditions and have relatively good control, as in our circle of family, our immediate friends, the places we go every day, and with the things we regularly work with and handle. Here, there is a great body of confirmation and reinforcement of our trust. You're probably familiar with the poem that says, "Raise a child with trust and it will grow up trusting." And yet there is something paradoxical about that. Perhaps you saw in the news the other day a story about children taken by court order from the custody of one of the more punitive religious cults. On the complaint that the children were being abused, the charge may be objectively true. The paradox is that some of the children protested at being removed. One of the 12-year-olds is reported to have said, "If I'm wicked, they should beat me." This child seemed to have internalized the assumptions of that insular society and is more ready to trust his ability to cope with what is familiar, even though he may not always like it, than to run the risk of leaving his small group for the wide and frightening other world. The point is that the faith that is easiest and simplest to come by is the faith that arises out of our familiar setting, our familiar experiences. A different sort of faith is needed in the larger setting when we face the unfamiliar, beyond the boundaries of our control, or most frightening of all, when we encounter people, communities, or societies whose aggressive assumptions are different and may even repudiate what we have. The sad story of the encounter of many relatively simple and unisolated communities when they were overwhelmed by invading Western ideas is only too familiar. They suffered disintegration of their whole societal structure based on because the assumptions that about reality which they trusted were repudiated. That makes no judgment about the absolute validity of either sets of assumptions. It simply shows that the unequal conflict of the two was destructive for one of them. We should be able to understand that. We often prefer neither to hear nor to face assertions about reality that aren't consistent with our faith structure. We are not particularly glad for stories in which what we count upon doesn't work. Sophia Faws, a Unitarian Universalist religious educator, in one of her early books, relates the reaction of a child who has been told not to be afraid to ride the swing because Jesus would not let her fall. But one day she fell. So let's play with that a little. What kinds of questions would occur in the mind of that child? One of the defenses we raise against challenges to our assumptions is that they didn't really happen. The girl might argue, "I didn't really fall. I must have been partly on my way out of the swing and misstepped." If that was not convincing, another way to hold on to the assumption she had accepted might be that I had not been a good girl, and so Jesus let me fall. Or at a somewhat more sophisticated level, and how many times have we heard this, "Jesus let me fall to test my faith. I guess my faith wasn't strong enough." This is hanging on desperately, not admitting that the premise may have failed. The other reaction is anger. "Teacher lied to me. She said this and it wasn't so." Or, "Jesus was bad to me. Jesus wasn't there at all. I didn't see him anywhere. I'll never trust that teacher or Jesus again." There are ways we attempt to cope with the shattering experiences that we take our given experiences, perhaps our too comfortable faith assumptions, and face them with a reality that doesn't fit. There are many stories in religion where that kind of encounter is dealt with, most of them not very satisfactorily. For the terror lurking behind challenges to our current faith structure, whatever it might be, is that if this one fails, there may be another. For the terror lurking behind challenges to our current faith system, whatever they may be, is that if our current faith system falls, there may not be another. If we have to regenerate a faith system, where will we find the stuff to build with? One way to forestall so traumatic an issue is to appeal to a distant time. Mourning the death of a friend, the poet Tennyson can say, "Oh, yet we trust that somehow good will be the final goal of ill." There is a kind of comfort in that. But you may need to ask the second question, how about right now? There is a traditional Jewish joke about the skeptic who was always being urged to have more faith. God has created the world. God has parted the Red Sea to allow the Jews to escape from Pharaoh. God has provided manna in the wilderness. God has sent the prophets and so on. Yes, yes, replies the skeptic, but what has he done for us recently? What about right now? In whatever the crisis, great or small, that you may be facing, what about right now? Maybe you are amongst those who are job hunting now, desperately in need of employment. Do I even dare try for it in this climate, this economic situation? Or maybe you're in a family conflict where you and those you care about are at odds. It is very painful and you must be reconciled. You want it terribly. But how do we start again? How do we get back on track? Or even worse, the relationship has fallen apart and you must go it alone, but I am hurt and scared. What kind of faith can come to your help at a time like that? In the traditional Christian faith picture, Jesus is by your side, or God is by your side. We are rightly impatient with these ideas taken with simple literalism, but taken as archetypal symbols, they may have a great deal of substance. Jesus is, for many people, the accepted spiritual image which draws together and validates all the personal support they have experienced or have known as an emptiness needing to be filled. Jesus is the figure in our culture, to summarize that, both in its positive and its negative aspects. All the potential for personal support rooted in anything good that has ever happened in your relationships with other people, or curiously and conversely that you have missed but have known as a recognizable emptiness. On the other hand, God, this cultural idea code word, is the image of cosmic support. Like the image Jesus, it is rooted in the astonishing reality. In this case, everything that accounts for you being here tangibly now. And also something implicit in what you have experienced as need. Now, words should not be belittled. They are both imprisoners and releasers of meaning. It's actually one of those beautiful phrases, I feel like, of this sermon. Words should not be belittled. They are both imprisoners and releasers of meaning. Language networks are the most facilitating instruments of consciousness yet to appear, but we need to be beware of mistaken worship. Words are bound to the cultures of their origin and their limitations. They are continuously being confronted with realities in which they can at best only point, never wholly define. There is no more intrinsic holiness or power in the multicultural word God, for example, than there is starch in the word potato. Another amazing phrase. Yet, by whatever name, starch and vitamins are essential to our nourishment. And behind the word God, the cosmos, the universe that has conceived and nourished the human possibility and that has brought you into being in particular, that cosmos is still here. The family of persons in whose community your personhood has emerged, acquire its shape, character, identity, language, and values, the family of persons is still here. The possibilities, the potentialities, which are singularly yours by virtue of your unique and unrepeatable being that you are still present and still worthy. And more than that, in botany, they speak of tropism, a growing towards the sun. There is a kind of tropism of spirit in a godlike, Christlike direction towards intelligent caring of people in the caring and intelligent community, which is real in you and is real in others. The source of faith on which you can rely and which you can indeed release, which can indeed release the creative potential in you, is that awareness that in your situations of crisis, whether it is great or small, you are not. And you need not be alone. The price of supporting community, moreover, does not have to be the sacrifice of one iota of your integrity, there is an irremovable possibility in you, in the community around you, in the world around you. Alas, it is set in a nest of other possibilities which are as destructive as they are creative. The extreme case is one in which many people have found themselves in the past, though you happily may not have, at least as of yet, the case where you are helpless in the hands of those who intend your destruction. This was the terrible fate of the prisoners in concentration camps. It is the fate today of people marked for death by death squads. Or not quite so personal, but every bit so fearsome, the case where you're helpless in the grips of forces which neither know or care. For the universe frequently does not seem to know or care what happens to its creations. This is the ultimate test of faith. And you may ask what faith can do for you in a time like that. Bring you magical rescue? A reprieve? That is an unanswerable question. People who have come through situations as desperate as that have frequently felt that they were given special hope, and that may be so. It could also just be the way we think. Can't answer that question. But suppose not. What then? Is there some inner victory of the trusting spirit? Again, no easy answers. Jesus on the cross is alleged to have cried, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? The question at that point goes blank. Speculations and mystic intuitions arise to fill the unbearable void. We never know whether they can be relied upon, but whatever accuracy there may be in descriptions that arise in ecstatic or even ecstatically terrible situations, whatever accuracy they may prove to have, they do attest in their curious way to the depth of stubborn affirmation, which is nothing less than awesome. Almost totally stripped of recognizable content, it nevertheless persists. It may be that we trust because we must. This last-ditch, back-to-the-wall imperative is not what we seem to require most of the time. Its power is present, however, in the greater fullness than we realize in much more conventional situations, that a deep trust in the abiding power of the possibilities which brought you into being will not bestow force or power upon you that you do not have, but it will help to liberate powers in you that you do have. And they are probably greater than what you ordinarily consider. For how intimidated we are in thousands of ways from drawing upon the full measure of growth and flexibility, ingenuity, cooperation, love that are our general, human, and individually personal bequests. Going back to our apocryphal story at the beginning, Noah in the ark had no sail, no oars. He could not help his friend, or could he? Could he have stripped a board from the roof? He did not need that much anymore. Could he have used it as a float, paddled out to rescue his former neighbor, still surviving though stranded? All the possibilities had not been explored. There were options in our story. He did not find them. Perhaps he was not looking for them. For in order to look for them and to use them, he would have had to care about his neighbor. But in the ancient biblical legends itself, care about the other people on the earth is one of the things that is missing. It is only after God saw the consequences of the flood of his anger that he relented and promised never to do it again. In the old stories, it took God such a long time to grow up. By no consequence, it took exactly the same time that it took people to come to more adequate awareness of what really mattered to them. This growth often came unpredictably in sudden spurts that would shine a while then fade away only to burst out again. How much growing is still needed in the gods of our chosen devotion, our national gods, our economic gods, our social gods? What I am saying is the resources for such growth are there. We need the deep trust that will open ourselves to them. We may be greatly surprised at the new things we are capable of alone and together. If we will use the intelligence we have, if we will admit and cultivate the care that is in us, If we will see what shines out of the images of the past at their greatest, we will find a faith for the long haul and for right now too. The search for it is the prayer that our companionship and our individual looking is really about. Amen, and blessed be.